From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Introducing Typhoon, a mine-resistant, ambush-protected, or MRAP, armored personnel carrier.
That was a clip from a promotional video for the Typhoon MRAP vehicle, a 4x4 multi-purpose armored personnel carrier with MRAP, or mine-resistant, ambush-protected, design, manufactured by the company Straight Group. The Typhoon is highly maneuverable, equally at home in urban, mountainous, and challenging rural terrains, and claims excellent field repairability. With the capacity to carry up to 12 personnel plus equipment, the Typhoon can be configured for a wide range of military missions, including command and control, patrol, convoy support, forward observation, reconnaissance, and medevac. In the words of the manufacturer, the Typhoon MRAP vehicle is
designed for today's unpredictable world.
On Friday, the public learned exactly how unpredictable that world might be, as the Greek Navy reportedly seized a huge cache of arms and military equipment being shipped by the United Arab Emirates to ISIL fighters in Libya, including Typhoon MRAP vehicles. According to a report from the website defensenet.gr, Greek OS and Navy Special Forces Thursday seized a shipment of cargo vehicles intended for ISIS in Libya. Prosecuting authorities in Greece reportedly had information that the cargo ship would try to deliver the illegal cargo to a port in Libya under the control of ISIS for its use in the war that's tearing apart that devastated country. The Greek forces reportedly found that the boat full of equipment had sailed from the UAE bound for Libya, which is under a strict arms embargo by the UN Security Council. According to Greek authorities, there were no documents on board authorizing the cargo's entry into Libya, namely end-use certificates from the UN, which made the cargo facially illegal. According to the report, the cargo found in the hold of the ship included the following: 18 MRAP-type Typhoon vehicles, 5 armored Model 200 Toyota Land Cruisers, 2 armored BMW vehicles, and 8 additional SUVs. According to the report, Greek authorities claimed they had reasonable suspicion that the cargo's intended final recipient was the terrorist group ISIS operating in Libya. They said the vehicles could provide ISIS with the ability to undertake rapid strikes around the country to enable it to occupy a larger part of Libya. Earlier this week, the Turkish Foreign Ministry said that a Turkish cargo ship off the coast of Tobruk, Libya, was attacked by warplanes and artillery, killing a Turkish officer and injuring members of the crew. That attack was the latest episode of violence against foreigners by armed factions within Libya. In January, a Greek-owned oil tanker was bombed in the same area by forces allied with the U.S.-backed government, which was based in Tobruk and Beida. A coup attempt in Burundi has been turned back, and the leader is reportedly on the run. Press TV's Kanis Fatima has more.
Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza is back in the capital, Bujumbura, following a failed coup attempt in the country. Meanwhile, the leader of the coup, General Godefroy Niyombare, is on the run after he managed to flee his captors following his arrest. Earlier, two other senior figures involved in the coup surrendered to the police. The coup was declared by a section of the military 2 days ago while the president was visiting Tanzania. Burundi plunged into turmoil after Nkurunziza officially announced he will run for president. The opposition calls this an unconstitutional third term in office. Burundi's civil society has called for fresh demonstrations in the country. To get more on this, we're being joined by our correspondent in Nairobi, Olivia Nurani, via Skype. Now, Olivia, tell us a bit more about what information we have about this failed coup attempt and also what we can expect Nkurunziza to say in this address later today.
Well, the authorities are saying so far, the latest is that they have arrested the three generals, including the deputy general who had participated in the attempted coup. Of course, they have sort of admitted that the attempt to oust the president has been thwarted. However, the main leader of the coup, who's a Major General Godefroy Niyombare, is still on the run. But they sort of have accepted that the coup you know, is not going to be possible because of the loyalists. Yes, we do understand that Nkurunziza is back into the country and he is supposed to give a national speech to the country later today afternoon. We are looking possibly at a situation where he is going to, celebrate, of course, his loyalists and condemn those in opposition. Not to forget, this whole bone of contention did obviously come about because of his wanting to participate in a third term of elections, which are supposed to be sometime next month. It also would be very interesting to see now how these elections are going to be held and how they will sort of come out. One of the main concerns, of course, with this violence, we still don't know how many people have lost their lives. There is no particular statistic that we can say how many people have lost their lives. But there has been increased concern, especially around the East African community, with this entire attempted coup that failed. Everybody is calling for calm. That is one of the main things he probably will be addressing the nation today, perhaps to restore calm into the country and get his loyalty back and win his loyalty back from the people.
Right. Speaking of which, Olivia, now that Nkurunziza has shown that he has survived this coup attempt, it further consolidates his power over the country. So it is safe to say that he will indeed be running for that third term now, wouldn't he?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is 2 weeks of violence, and you're looking at an entire military trying to really overthrow the government. So you can imagine how strong his loyalists have been. In fact, not to forget the state television. They tried to seize the state television, the state radio, and they were really not successful. So he does obviously have very strong support in Burundi. And he may also just take, the term, the third term that he's been vying for now as a contender.
In Beijing Friday, China's Prime Minister Li Keqiang and India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi reportedly signed 24 agreements worth more than $10 billion. CCTV's Clint DeLoach has more.
Modi met with Chinese Premier Li Keqiang today in Beijing's Great Hall of the People. Speaking after the meeting, Premier Li said the talks met expectations and touched upon a wide range of topics. On his part, Modi said cooperation between China and India would not just bring benefits to the two countries, but would also send a positive signal to the world. The two leaders then witnessed the signing of a total of 24 deals aimed at boosting cooperation in areas including rail transportation, aerospace, mineral exploitation, marine science, and education. The two sides also agreed to set up new consulates in Chengdu in southwest China and in India's Chennai. Modi's three-day tour is his first visit to China since he became prime minister.
Guyana's opposition coalition has reportedly won the national election, ending the rule of the Indo-Guyanese party that had a grip on the country's power for the last 23 years. The Partnership for National Unity and Alliance for Change coalition, led by former Army General David Granger, won the election reportedly by a margin of 5,000 votes against the ruling party, the People's Progressive Party. Granger said at his Georgetown home after the results were announced that his six-party coalition was the closest Guyana has ever seen of a government of national unity. Late last year, President Donald Ramotar suspended parliament to avoid a vote of no confidence. However, mounting international pressure forced him to call for early national elections. In 2011, his PPP party lost its majority in parliament after Granger's coalition managed to attract significant indigenous voters. The elections were observed by international missions that included the Carter Center, led by former U.S. President Jimmy Carter. The international observers said that Thursday's elections were fairly conducted. However, President Ramotar said the election was rigged and demanded a full recount. He told the Associated Press that he was not conceding and would not rule out any options. The 15-member Caribbean Community, or CARICOM, said it hopes the results of the poll will be accepted and respected. And there were a number of other developments in the region south of El Rio Grande to report. With more, we go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo.
People are quite concerned about whether it's a phenomenon that meteorologists call El Nino, that generally causes prolonged periods of drought in the region, is going to establish itself here. Right. And it did last year. In the first half of last year, farmers all along the Nicaraguan and Salvadoran and Honduran Pacific coast were, and Guatemala, of course, were affected by prolonged dry weather. And people are quite anxious that that might happen again, because I mean, in these largely agricultural economies, and that's of huge importance for hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people who depend on that agricultural activity. So there's that concern.
How's the water infrastructure there in terms of helping to get through drought periods, reservoirs and such?
Well, here in our part of Nicaragua, the water supply depends largely on wells. And it's been interesting in recent articles attacking the proposal for the Nicaraguan canal, the level of ignorance that people who should know better display about how Nicaragua's water supply works, because Nicaragua has one of the best water profiles in the region, between the Great Lakes and the big water aquifers down in South America. And but if you were to read the articles criticizing the proposals for the Nicaraguan canal, you'd think that Nicaragua depended on Lake Nicaragua for its water, and of course it doesn't. And almost all the Pacific coast depends on wells to get their water.
Is the lake freshwater or saltwater?
It's freshwater. It's a freshwater lake.
Yeah.
The watersheds in Nicaragua, there are two or three, and I think there are a total of six actually watersheds that are of major national importance, and they flow down to Pacific, down to Atlantic, and there's the historic problem in Nicaragua has been lack of capacity to manage the water supply correctly. It's not, the problem isn't a lack of water, it's a lack of water management infrastructure, and that's another of the big issues in Nicaragua that the government of President Daniel Ortega has been working to try and overcome and improve. And the canal project is viewed by the government as one of the, probably the key project over the next 10 years that's going to dramatically improve Nicaragua's ability to manage its abundant water in a much better way, in a much more rational way.
Yeah, you have, if you think about it at all, and you understand the way that Nicaragua's conducted these negotiations, and also the way that China tends towards this, a remanaging of that much water in a project that's going to double the economy in 6 years or whatever it was gives the government more resources to the build from scratch, if that's what they had to do, new additional infrastructure. But also, in the process of building it, there are ways of finding synergy with that project, because you're managing so much water and you have all this other infrastructure to build around the canal that can double duty.
Yeah, and there are so many associated issues with the water management issue here in Nicaragua, and the expansion of the agricultural frontier here, and I'm sure it's very similar in other Central American and Latin American countries, that certainly in Nicaragua, as the agricultural economy develops, paradoxically, improving people's economic lives, it actually implies a deterioration in their environment, because the expansion of the agricultural frontier diminishes forest resources, diminishes water resources, puts those resources in peril. Here where I live in northern Nicaragua, for example, there's a very aggressive expansion of the tobacco industry, which uses water in a very irrational way. and also contaminates water sources at the same time as it's expanding its production. That's, you know, it's very similar to the kind of dilemmas that present themselves throughout Latin America. The governments anxious to eradicate poverty find themselves faced with the dilemma of, well, how do we generate economic production, but at the same time do so in a sustainable way that doesn't completely destroy our natural resources?
Well, look to the United States for a model. What they do is let the corporation decide what's going to make them the most money, and that's what gets done. That's who you should take advice from, of course.
So, yeah, and of course, a lot of that dilemma is reflected in the disputes that we're seeing. For example, the other day there was a vicious repression in Peru of a dispute in an area where there's a contentious mining project in Honduras, in particular, up on the northern Atlantic coast. The Garifuna people's organizations are mobilizing against encroachment on their lands by agricultural and mining interests. The same in other indigenous peoples' areas in throughout Central America and Latin America. So that's, you know, it's a very important theme in the way Latin American governments and Latin American peoples are trying to cope with their efforts, the consequences of their efforts to overcome poverty.
Right. Yeah.
So, and yeah, there's all kinds of things associated with that issue, aren't there? And then corruption is a big issue. And here in Central America, recently we've had the case of the Guatemalan vice president who was forced to resign as a result of her alleged involvement in a big fraud in Guatemalan's National Customs Authority. Kind of mini constitutional crisis went on for, you know, something like a month before it was resolved, I think yesterday or the day before, by a vote in Guatemala's legislature for a new vice president, for somebody who's not as controversial as the person who was forced to resign. And you know, that may or may not mean that the crisis in Guatemala is finally resolved, but for the moment, it looks as though the Guatemalan president Otto Perez has bought himself at least some time. And then you've got the issue of corruption in Honduras, saying the government there is, as Juan Orlando Hernandez's National Party government, has been implicated in what, terms of Hondurans, the Honduras economy is a huge fraud of $300 million. That's just gone missing from the country's Institute of Social Security.
Oops. Yes.
So, you know, and the opposition, including Mel Zelaya and Xiomara Castro de Zelaya's Libre Party, kind of campaigning around that, and they're talking about trying to insist on a revocatory referendum, very like the revocation mechanism in Venezuela, but I can't see that happening anytime soon.
No, me neither.
So that issue of corruption, of course, is very much to the fore in Brazil, where three former members of the legislature have been accused by the public prosecutor in Brazil, the federal public prosecutor in Brazil, of corrupt activities involving the state oil company Petrobras.
Yes.
Then, of course, in Chile, and I think we were talking last week about that very damaging corruption scandal involving the son and his wife, the son of President Michelle Bachelet.
Right.
So there's That corruption theme is one that's become very much to the fore over the last week or so in throughout Latin America.
Yeah, it's it's almost a stock in trade for political attacks to expose. I wouldn't even say accuse, expose corruption because it is so pervasive across the board. It's a magnet for, like Willie Sutton, why do you rob banks? That's where the money is. Why do you go into politics? For, if you're a crook, you go there because that's where you can go steal. And to me, it's really unfortunate that Bachelet allowed herself to be exposed like that.
Yeah. And the modern variant on robbing banks is the best way to steal a bank is to own one, right?
Yeah, that's for sure.
And that's cropped up in Panama. Apparently, there's the government's investigating banks in Panama for their involvement in corruption.
Yep.
So yeah, and that's there's that going on. And a couple of moving on to more specific political stuff.
Yeah.
Of course the. For a lot of us, the big event of the week was the 70th anniversary commemoration activities in Moscow of what people in the Russian Federation call the Great Patriotic War.
Right. That's right. It was the defeat of Nazism by the Soviet Red Army.
Yeah. So that commemoration activity was very, very important for people in Latin America because it showed in a very concrete way, because with the presence at the celebration of President Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela. And he was there, he gave a very interesting interview on RT, the program, the channel that also hosts that crosstalk program that you had on, as we started to talk,
and which I'll be on again this week or next week. By the way, I'll be on that.
Right. Oh, great.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah, I get to do that every now and then. I like that. And Peter told me the other day that I'll be on soon, so that usually means within a week or two.
Look forward to that.
Thanks.
So yeah, and that that interview was very important because if people get the chance to look at it, it's up on YouTube, on RT. And it was a key opportunity for President Maduro and the other Latin American countries, in particular Nicaragua, here in Central America, which has very close relations with the Russian Federation, to meet President Vladimir Putin and President Xi Jinping, because Xi Jinping was sitting beside Vladimir Putin at the commemoration event in Moscow's Red Square.
Right.
And that it was very, very symbolic. And there it's very clear that there are kind of two worlds developing, very, very well-defined blocks developing. There's the block of countries associated with the United States and its allies, and their failed neoliberal model of consumer capitalism that's completely failed to meet the needs of their country's people. And you have the other developing bloc of a very strong and close strategic alliance between Russia and China, and countries that recognize that emerging bloc as the pole that they prefer to work with against what's regarded as the counterproductive and unhelpful influence, and in many cases the covert and sometimes overt military aggression of the United States and its Western allies, and that's certainly the case in Venezuela.
For sure. For sure. And, the BRICS countries, they've been accelerating
the integration of their relations, particularly since the U.S. Started on Russia and China with the pivots and Ukraine and all that. But now, even within themselves, they're working on ironing out some of the problems that they have, because there are contradictions between each of the countries. Modi's been in Beijing, and it's expected that India and China are going to work out some major agreements during this trip. That's apparently the intention.
Well, yeah, and that's a very important move, isn't it? In historic terms, India and China have had many, many disputes, border disputes. And I think at one point, if I remember right, I was a child at the time, I think they even went to war.
Yeah, they had a hot war, they did. Yep. And now, I mean, we're talking about just about half of humanity between those two countries, almost.
Right, yeah. And so that and China's influences grow very, very much growing in Latin America, and not just the Nicaraguan canal, but all kinds of bilateral swap arrangements, for example, with Argentina. And China is now Brazil's main trading partner. And that in terms of the kind of tug of war between Russia, China, and the BRICS countries, and their influence in Latin America, and the influence of North America, Canada, and the US, and their European allies in the region. And it's very clear that the Europeans and the US are very much on the defensive, because another big announcement this week was the decision to go ahead with a railway that crosses from Peru to Bolivia,
right?
To Brazil,
right.
From, yeah. And that's regarded as the South American, although it's a huge distance. Imagine the distance between the Peru's Pacific coast and the Atlantic coast of Bolivia.
It's like California to New York, yeah.
Right. So and that huge railway is going to be built, and it's being promoted as South America's alternative to the Panama Canal.
Uh-huh. Yep.
So, and the interesting thing about that is, look at the member countries. It's Peru and Brazil.
Right.
Now, Peru is very much in alliance with
the U.S.
With the United States in terms of its economic philosophy, and in terms of its involvement, for example, in the Pacific Alliance,
right,
which is on the threshold of this huge corporate welfare, a massive corporate welfare program, the Trans-Pacific Partnership,
yeah, that
Barack Obama was trying to fast-track through Congress. And he had a kind of minor setback with a vote in the Senate that is likely to be overturned in the next couple of weeks, as I understand
it. It's overturned. Apparently, they have the votes for it now.
Right, yeah. So that's going to go to the House of Representatives, and who knows what's going to happen. There'll be all kind of arms twisting and bribery and corruption going on in the House of Representatives from the part of the White House.
They have it there, too, now. They have
right,
it.
So,
yeah, so it's going through, yeah.
So that's going through, and what that means is that countries like Peru, Chile, Colombia, Mexico will sign up to that massive corporate welfare boondoggle, with all the effects that that'll have here in the region. And of course, and that has very, very serious implications for the integration process here in Latin America and the Caribbean, because in the same way that one of the Russian Federation's huge objections to the incorporation of the Ukraine into an agreement of association with the European Union was that would completely upset the tariff arrangements within the Russian Federation's trade area.
Right.
Because Ukraine would then become kind of Trojan horse, allowing
right.
Imports from the European Union to have privileged access that they wouldn't otherwise have.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.